Hi, I'm Trevor, and welcome to Catching Up on Cinema. If you aren't familiar with the program, Catching Up on Cinema is a film analysis podcast wherein we introduce each other to films, expand our cinematic horizons, and, in essence, catch up on our cinema. So it is the month of June, and we are heading into 8 weeks sans Kyle. So I don't really have a plan as far as themes are considered for the next 8 weeks or so. But rest assured, we'll more than likely have some guest co-hosts on the show to keep me company and keep me sane. But in the meantime, today is just going to be a solo episode featuring myself talking to myself. And also, I'm not sure if this is going to end up turning into a proper review. This is more just me kind of word vomiting my way through, having some diarrhea of the mouth. About a movie that I watched last night. I did intend to record this review or talk or whatever you want to call it last night, but it was too damn late and I was too damn tired. And as a result, you're getting this episode a day late, so apologies there. So to dispel the mystery, I went with the girlfriend and a very close friend of mine, the three of us, we all went to the theater for a Fathom event screening of Shin Kamen Rider, which is something I, and no one else in that crew, was somewhat hyped for. I've seen all the Shin movies up to this point, well, officially now I guess I've seen all of them, and in terms of my connection to the franchise, I do actually have some. Like, I actually do have some connection to the broader Kamen Rider universe, I guess, as it were. So just to set the stage, I guess I should explain things, because I know this is more than likely going to be a very, very, very niche film for quite a lot of people. More than likely a lot of people listening to this, if anybody listens to this. So I may as well explain exactly what this is. So Shin Kamen Rider came out in the year 2023. In fact, it came out in March in its native country of Japan, so it's actually kind of special that we would get a fully English subtitled screening in theaters in my region, in the U.S. And they did so with the previous release in this multimedia franchise, or whatever you want to call it, with the release of Shin Ultraman as well, which I did see in the theaters, same deal, Fathom event. So what this is they have a loose, I don't even know if they're officially connected, but they all have one major entity, one major connective element that unifies all of them, this Shin film universe that they have, this cinematic universe, I guess. There's a lot of actual creative personalities that tie all of this together, but the major one comes in the form of the director, who is, of course, Hideaki Anno, who is a very fascinating individual in the world of Japanese media and these days in Japanese film. So if you're not familiar, Hideaki Anno kind of came to prominence, or like his biggest claim to fame, especially, you know, in the earlier days of his career, was he was responsible for the Neon Genesis Evangelion franchise. So not just the television show, but I believe also the manga and the subsequent remake films in more recent years. Now, if you're not familiar with what that is, I apologize. I'm not exactly the best person to try to explain it to you. I don't think there is anybody on the planet that could very cleanly and succinctly explain it to you. But if you were around for it and you were down for the sort of vibe that it gave off, it was special. It's by no means a perfect media property, but it is wholly unique and distinct. It's very much a product of a specific creative voice. And as a result, when he grew beyond that, as he's grown beyond that franchise, it's been very interesting to see what his creative voice looks like when playing with other people's toys, because he is such a unique voice. He's borderline auteur, if you believe in that sort of thing, in the world of film. But Evangelion was very unique. It was imitated many times. And in fact, part of what makes it special is that many aspects of it were, especially in the early days, early in production of that anime in particular, were imitative and paying direct homage to many of the media properties that the director is currently working with. So in some ways, I guess he's come full circle. He went from paying homage to franchises like Godzilla and Ultraman and Kamen Rider to literally making entries in those franchises. It's really special. It's not every day you get to see that sort of thing happen on such a grand scale. But Evangelion came out in the, I believe it was the late 90s. It was like the mid to late 90s. And it was a phenomenon. It was a huge deal. But production of that through the animation studio Gainax also threw the man into a horrible doom spiral of depression. And it manifested, you better believe it manifested, in his storytelling. And as a result, the later chapters of that particular franchise, not by today's standard, but during its original run in the 90s, became obscenely dark and twisted, and very, very depressing. It's debatable, I guess, as to whether it ended up being good, in the traditional sense. I, for one, got something out of the end of Evangelion, but that is a highly divisive film. Check it out, I guess. Not a very strong recommend. It is, as I said, everything the man touches is going to be 100% unique. It is going to be very much an Anno production. But I do know that that movie is extraordinarily divisive. Some people absolutely find it detestable and just a complete, I don't know, trip and fall flat on your fucking face kind of production. Anyway, that was a long time ago, though. And in subsequent years, beginning in, was it 2016, I believe, or 2014? I forget what year it happened. In fact, I should probably use the powers of the internet to look it up, but I'm not gonna. Shin Gojira was Hideaki Anno's kind of return to the spotlight of sorts. I mean, he has done works in live action previously. He's done some short films, one of which is actually very, very interesting because I believe it's actually a callback to one of his first gigs in the world of animation. Remember, the man does have a background in anime, in animation. If memory serves, one of his earlier gigs was doing some of the I think they call it the God Warrior, the melting fellow, the giant melty man at the end of Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind. It's like big finale sequence. It's really gruesome to look at. It's a Studio Ghibli production. He worked on some of the, I think, the key animation for that. And I believe I don't remember if he directed it, but they did end up doing like a live action short featuring that same character, but in live action using suitmation and CGI. So like miniatures and man in rubber monster suit, like Daikaiju style. Very interesting. I don't remember if he directed that or if he was just involved in that production, but that was interesting to see, again, kind of like going full circle, because that came out probably in the late 2000s or the 2010s or something. But in the past, in the 2000s, Anno did direct Cutie Honey, which is a anime. It's a live action anime adaptation from the mid 2000s that actually did remind me of this one a little bit, or reverse that. It bears some resemblance to this one, at least stylistically, to some degree. That movie's a lot louder and more colorful, for sure. But I think that may have been one of his earliest live-action productions. But so what I'm getting at here is that the man has worked in multiple mediums. But the most important thing is the Shin movies. So I was right. It was 2016. Shin Gojira. Shin Godzilla came out in 2016, and if memory serves, it won the equivalent of the Japanese Best Picture. And deservedly so. I thought that was a fantastic fucking film. I really quite enjoyed that. And I've been trying to get the girlfriend to watch it for a very long time. I've been I gave it a pet name. I nicknamed the movie Bureaucracy Godzilla, because I haven't actually checked, but if I had to guess, if you were to submit it to like the Academy, like for the Oscars or something, I want to say that maybe the official genre classification of that movie is probably like black comedy or something, because it is a slyly comedic film, extraordinarily quick and deadpan, but there are some laugh out loud just like sequences in that movie that had me rolling on the floor with just how sadly absurd they were, and also how genuine and true to life they were. You'll understand if you watch it, but I really, really quite enjoyed that movie, and it was also very politically relevant too, because that came out, you know, a few years removed from the Fukushima disaster, and also the Japanese government's response to that particular disaster, of which the movie is pretty boldly critical of, and probably deservedly so. Point is, that's fucking Godzilla. In 2016, 2 years removed from the very successful, I believe, American 2014 Godzilla film. So Godzilla was back on the menu, boys, in 2016. And Godzilla's always going to put asses in seats. He's a powerhouse. He's a mega franchise. He's been around since 1954. I love him. I will show the fuck up for anything that has Godzilla's name on it. And what we have here is the director, an auteur director of a very complex and very unique Japanese animated series that was, I believe, very financially successful, but also, again, very complex and very strange, from the 90s, being handed the keys to the fucking castle of Godzilla in 2016. And wouldn't you know it, he knocked it out of the park and he won the equivalent of a best fucking picture. What that resulted in was many of the other Japanese mega franchises in like live-action sci-fi or tokusatsu. Godzilla does fit into that category, by the way. Anything involving a lot of suitmation generally falls into that category, but Godzilla most certainly does fall under that umbrella. All the other biggest tokusatsu productions, with the exception of Super Sentai, have now also kind of laid down, like bowed their head at the altar of Anno and handed the keys to their respective castles. And wouldn't you know it, it seems like every single time he's done quite a good job in handling the property. And part of that probably comes from the fact that, again, Evangelion had their DNA wrapped up in it. The man likes these franchises. He genuinely has quite a lot of love for all of these franchises. And it kind of shows on the screen in every instance. Like, Godzilla has quite a lot of loving references paid to films of the past. Shin Ultraman most assuredly does have a lot of love for so much of that franchise. And in fact, if you ask me, that one in a lot of ways bears of like the strongest resemblance to Evangelion in some ways. I mean, the whole team arrangement and the whole sciencing the shit out of everything in that movie felt very Eva to me. Which brings us to Shin Kamen Rider. So now we have Kamen Rider, which is another mega franchise. So just to, again, fully explain everything, I'm trying to conduct this talk as if somebody doesn't know anything about anything. So I apologize if I'm, you know, just saying things that you already know, but Godzilla came out in the 1950s, 1954 to be specific, and persists to this day. Godzilla vs. Kong 2, or whatever the fuck they're calling it, is currently in production and is due out soon. Ultraman came out in 1966, and is a mega franchise in Japan that persists to this very day. They're still cranking out at least one TV show every single year, like clockwork. They have stage shows, they have toys, they have video games. In recent years, Tsuburaya Productions, that is the studio that owns the rights to Ultraman, has been making major steps to try to break out into the Western market for the character. I've been seeing a lot of advertisements on YouTube and just a lot of online buzz suggesting that they're putting some ad dollars towards trying to make Ultraman a thing here. And also, it's worth pointing out that I am a collector of physical media, and Mill Creek Entertainment, regardless of how you feel about that particular publisher of Blu-rays, they currently have the rights to Ultraman media in the States, and they have been pretty consistently putting out a diverse array of Ultraman products on Blu-ray as of late. So Ultraman's trying to break out in the West. And Kamen Rider, though, came out in 1971. I believe that was the first TV show iteration of it, which is what I am most familiar with. But it's very important to note that unlike Godzilla and unlike Ultraman, Kamen Rider has its origins in manga. Kamen Rider is a product of the author Shotaro Ishinomori, who was a prolific mangaka, or like comic author in Japan. He gave us a lot of very, very good manga that I have not read, but I do know that his name carries an immense amount of weight, largely associated with Kamen Rider. But also, I believe the character Skull Man may actually predate Kamen Rider to some extent. I forget who's the chicken and who's the egg in that particular equation. But I do know that they bear some resemblance. They both involve like shadowy organizations and kind of like reluctant anti-heroes, and also quite a lot of bloodletting, at least in the manga version. But yeah, Kamen Rider came out in the 70s in 1971, so we have three mega franchises that I forgot to mention. Kamen Rider persists to this very day, very similar to Ultraman. It has at least an annual entry in its television iterations every single year, and it's owned by Toei Studios, who kind of have like a parallel thing going where they own both Super Sentai, Power Rangers, to those who may not be aware. Super Sentai is the Japanese equivalent of Power Rangers. They often pair those two, and they do like festival screenings where they'll have that year's Super Sentai movie paired with that year's Kamen Rider movie. So what I'm trying to get at is all three of these franchises are like the equivalent to a fucking MCU unto themselves. So this is big fucking time to the people who give a shit. Which, if we're being honest, the target audience for most of these, with the exception of, I guess, Godzilla these days, but with Ultraman and Kamen Rider, more so Ultraman, the target audience is generally very small children. However, that was not always the case. The original version of Ultraman kind of became intended for children, but it wasn't always meant to be that. It was more just like a sci-fi television show that somebody got wise to the fact that it's like, hey, if we make it more colorful, the kids seem to like the big silver man that beats up the rubber monster at the end of the show, so maybe we should do more of that. Whereas Kamen Rider, the manga source material was very dark. Very, very dark. But the television show was a little bit more lighthearted, more kind of similar to like the Adam West Batman show, although it had more of an edge because there was quite a lot more emphasis on the punching, the kicking, and the bloodletting, which is why I like it. but as for myself, this is turning into, I don't even know what this conversation is, but as for myself, my connection to Kamen Rider, I guess began in the 90s. I did, like, you may be surprised by this, I didn't give two shits. I had zero fucks to give for the Kamen Rider, or Masked Rider, excuse me, Masked Rider television show that came out in the States in the 90s. What that was an attempt on the part of, I have to assume, Toei, to ape the success of Power Rangers. in our region, because Power Rangers, if you grew up in the 90s, you'll know, became a big fucking deal very, very quickly, almost instantaneously. And it's kind of a big fucking deal today, as far as I can tell. Like, there's still a passionate fan base, although that may just be an adult thing. I don't know how much the kids are into it here these days. I don't really have many kids I interact with that would be able to tell me that. But Masked Rider, as it was called here, came out very shortly thereafter, and I believe they used a Kamen Rider RX, or Black RX, excuse me, as the special effects footage for that show, and they shat the bed with the translation. They completely shat the bed with it. Even as a kid, I was just like, fuck this, I can't be bothered with this. But there was Kamen Rider Zou, which came out in the early 90s as a like an OVA, like it was a direct-to-video movie. And through happenstance, I actually caught some clips of it at a comic book shop. And what's funny is that I thought that was super awesome. And it just so happened that the director of that, Keita Amemiya, has gone on to become like a personal favorite of mine, such that I would love to do a spotlight month just for him. That was probably my first exposure to his work, was just going to a fucking comic book store with my grandma while my mom was shopping at Costco, and I just saw this grasshopper man fighting this other mutant grasshopper man, and I was like, I don't know what this is, but I need this in my life. And beyond that, I do remember that they actually had a Sega CD game, like an FMV game, like a Dragon's Lair style FMV game of Kamen Rider Zou that I think they may have called it Kamen Rider Zou in our region, but it did come out in this region. I never played it. I've actually never played a actual Sega CD. I think I've played some emulated games at some point. Don't tell anyone. But I remember seeing a review for that game in like a GamePro or something or other. And the screenshots were fantastic, even though I guess the game didn't do all that well. But after that, my connection to the franchise, like I was aware of Kamen Rider. I was aware that Masked Rider was a thing. I didn't really have much exposure to it outside of just seeing a couple of action sequences playing on a shitty CRT television. Like, it was shitty because it was a bootleg movie. You need to understand, like, it had been copied a few times, and it was certainly being sold for $50 fucking dollars at that store, which is why I didn't go home with it. It wouldn't be until I was like in college, actually, and I had ready access to BitTorrent, the school network. No, it wasn't the school network. I was working outside of it. The first show of Kamen Rider that I watched and immediately got hooked by was Kamen Rider Kabuto, which was a lot of fun. I had quite a lot of fun with it. I watched all of it. In fact, I own the movie version, Godspeed Love. Love that title. on a DVD. Foreign region DVD, region 2. I can no longer watch it because I gave the player to the ex-girlfriend. Whoops. But I watched Kabuto. And then the big one was Den-O. Kamen Rider Den-O. I forget if there was a show in between that. If there was, it didn't register with me because Den-O, I think I wasn't alone in my appreciation for that, because as far as I could tell, that one hung around a lot longer than some of the other ones. Like I said, it's generally like an annual thing. Like you get 1 year of this Kamen Rider and then we're on to the next. That one, I'm pretty sure they found excuses to keep bringing it back because it was so damn fun. And all of the voice actors involved and all of the suit actors involved in bringing all of the different characters to life, of which they had a very colorful and very large cast of characters for that show, kind of unusual. Everybody brought their A game to that one. And it needs to be said, Takeru Sato, the actor, that was my first exposure to him. And he would go on to star in the Rurouni Kenshin movies. And yeah, as soon as I saw him in Den-O, I was like, oh yeah, this kid can act. Like, I don't know how old he was in that show, but having to wear so many hats and portray so many different personalities with his body language told me quite a lot about his capabilities. And so by the time he got to Kenshin and his career today, it's always cool to see the come up and to see him go from being the lead actor in a children's television show to headlining summer blockbuster films. It's kind of like Shia LaBeouf, but not bad, I guess. But yeah, watch the hell out of Den-O. Enough detail. Point is, in more recent years, from like my college years onwards, so like mid-2000s to the present, I no longer watch the show, but I have a special place in my heart for Ultraman and Kamen Rider, like all tokusatsu in general, but Kamen Rider and Ultraman are kind of special to me, and my ears always perk up when I hear there's stuff going on. In fact, I actually roped the girlfriend into watching Kamen Rider Black Sun with me, which I believe came out only a couple years ago. That was a show. Like, that was way more political than I was expecting. I was like, holy shit, this is serious. I thought it was just going to be, you know, guys kicking each other and going, "Twah!" The girlfriend liked it. She didn't know shit about Kamen Rider. I didn't know shit about what to expect from that show because it threw me so many curveballs. But I was shocked to discover that that show is actually available on Amazon Prime in the U.S. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, I mean, I love Kamen Rider Black. In fact, I'm currently watching it on Blu-ray. It did come out in our region, and it is often regarded as one of the very best Kamen Rider shows. But yeah, somehow I managed to twist the girlfriend's arm into watching that with me, and she ended up liking it quite a lot, such that she was actually kind of hyped for this movie. That really surprised me. But I should probably talk about the movie. And like I said, I'm not sure if this is going to be a review. I don't think I have it in me, because I'm sure there's a lot of complexities to this film that, you know, it probably went directly over my head, especially because Anno seems to just delight in having absolutely rapid fucking fire dialogue in all of his productions. And, you know, when it's late and you've had a lot of salt in your meal before you got to the theater and you're an old man and you're confused, sometimes it can be a bit much, and I'll get there when I get there. But point is, this film, Shin Kamen Rider, or Kamen Rider, came out in 2023. In March in Japan, and it was like a three-night theatrical screening event hosted by Fathom in the U.S. And just to run down the cast real quick, as I said, it's directed by Hideaki Anno, and I went over him, so I don't need to go over him again. I will point out, I think... okay, so let's go over the cast real quick. So we have Sosuke Ikematsu as Takeshi Hongo, who is Kamen Rider 01, or the OG Kamen Rider. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about most of these folks, because if I'm being honest, I recognize many faces, but it's difficult for me to pin down exactly where I've seen them. However, this fella, fun little trivia factoid, apparently one of his first, if not his very first, acting debut came in the form of a U.S. production, The Last Samurai. He plays Higen, who is the older son in the family that Tom Cruise is staying with in that film. Koyuki is the mom, or the wife with the widowed mother. And Higen is the older son who Tom Cruise kind of bonds with. But it looks like he has a very healthy career. He's a funny looking guy. He's got a big forehead. Let's say that much. We have Minami Hamabe as Rudiko, who is our female lead. She kind of hit it big in Let Me Eat Your Pancreas, which I know, hell of a title, I know, but I have heard good things about that. And it looks like also she is doing quite well, doing quite a lot of manga and anime, like live action adaptations. And funny enough, it looks like her theatrical debut came in the form of the Ace Attorney movie, Gyakuten Saibon, the Phoenix Wright, the video game adaptation. That's fun. We have Tasuku Emoto as Hayato Ichimonji, who is Kamen Rider 02, or Nigo. He kind of stole the show in this movie, I'm not going to lie. He brought quite a lot of levity to the proceedings. He has pretty much all the comedic dialogue in this movie, of which there's not a whole lot until maybe the second half or so. But on the whole, his energy brings a lot to the proceedings. I quite liked him in this. I wish he had been introduced much earlier, if I'm being honest. But in looking over his filmography, do I see anything that rings a bell? No, not especially, which is unfortunate. Oh, hey, he was in Chameleon, which is a crime thriller from 2008 that I have wanted to see for a very long time, but I haven't had the means to, because it's only available on Region 2 DVD, and it's not subtitled, so I haven't been able to watch that one, but I have heard very good things. Oh, and it looks like he was actually in the Great War of Archimedes, also with Minami Hamabe, the lady I just mentioned prior to him. We have Nanase Nishino as Hiromi, who is the wasp kaijin, or ogs, as they call them in this. She's an idol. She's done stuff. So she's done singing, she's done dancing, she's done variety television, quite a lot of it, in fact. Big one, who I can't remember, actually, if he's in Shin Ultraman. I have to assume he is. But he's one of the common cast members, cast members across many, if not all, of these Shin movies. We have Shinya Tsukamoto as Dr. Midorikawa. He's only in a little bit of this movie, but if you don't recognize the name, Shinya Tsukamoto is actually a director who also, he does some acting. He did the Tetsuo films, so he has done some crazy shit. And I believe he's actually a personal friend of Anno. He may be a contemporary as well. He is actually very, very good in Shin Gojira. Again, I can't remember if he's in Ultraman. But yeah, he shows up briefly in this, and he's always welcome. He's a pretty good actor. We have Toru Tezuka as the Bat Kaijin, or Bat Og. I found his character to be very obnoxious. He speechifies for far too long. And his makeup is fine, but the CGI for his flying, of which we hold on quite often and too long, was very, very distracting. Toru Tezuka, he's not a name that is familiar to me, and he was covered in quite a lot of makeup and CGI, so it was difficult to make out exactly who he is. But I have to assume he's a friend of Anno's. We have Kanata Hongo as the mantis slash chameleon Og, who shows up much later in the film. He's done also quite a lot of live-action anime adaptations. Oh, wow, he's in Inuyashiki. That's another one that I've been meaning to see, as well as the Attack on Titan and Gantz live-action adaptations. And, oh, hey, his first credit here. Holy shit, he was in Moonchild, the Gakuto movie. His first credit here is a little movie called Returner, which is a movie that I really quite like. I haven't watched it in a really long time, but it came out in 2002, and it stars Takeshi Kaneshiro, who I was very into there for a minute. I don't know if he had much of a role in that, but it was his first role, and that's kind of fun. That I haven't thought of that movie in a really, really long time. We have Nao Omori as the voice of the spider Og. Now I need to point out, this fella plays the titular Ichi in Ichi the Killer. If you haven't seen that movie, maybe look it up before you watch it, it might not be for you. We have Masami Nagasawa, who is only in one scene, but it is quite memorable and quite embarrassing if you're sitting next to your girlfriend in a theater. She's done quite a lot of stuff. Hell, she's been in a Godzilla movie. I'm trying to think of anything in particular. Oh, she's, again, has a lot of experience doing a lot of live-action anime adaptations. A couple other people, just to round out the cast here, worth noting are Takumi Saito, who is a prolific actor. He actually has a role in a movie that I quite enjoyed. Reborn? He and Yutaka Takenouchi play shady government agents. The latter, Takenouchi, he is very important to note because he is also similar to Shinya Tsukamoto, an actor who is present in, I want to say, all of the Shin movies. Almost like 100% certain he was in all three of them. I believe he's supposed to be playing different characters, though. I could be wrong on that. It's been a while since I've seen Shin Gojira. But he most certainly has showed up in all three movies, and he plays government agents in all three of those movies. Also, needs to be said, Mirai Moriyama plays, essentially, he ends up being very, very important in the film. Essentially the chief antagonist of sorts, although the way he arrives at that is a little odd. He was in Samurai Marathon in 2019, which is actually a Western production, also featuring the aforementioned Takeru Sato. He was also in all of the 20th Century Boys movies, which I was told by a friend of mine who lives in Japan it's like it was a big fucking deal. It's like the equivalent of like Stephen King's The Stand or something, but in the world of manga. And I haven't heard anyone talk about those movies in a long time. So I don't know if they suck or if it just failed to reach beyond Japan. But yeah, those happened, all three of them, in 2008 and 2009. So this movie, in terms of my feelings about it, I will defend Anno's direction. I feel that he is a truly gifted director. He really does have a kind of like a singular vision and a singular approach to how he likes to handle his cinematography and his editing in particular. There's quite a lot of creative camera angles, some fun edits. There's at least one very humorous edit on the film that really, really worked for me. But in a lot of ways, this movie felt the least cohesive of these Shin movies. Shin Gojira had a lot of interesting and topical things to say that were pretty cleanly communicated to us, the viewer. There is a lot of noise, like there is a lot of detail. Anno has, he always has tons of extraneous details in his stories. In a lot of ways, this is probably an unfair comparison, but I think of him and the game developer, Hideo Kojima, I think of them in the same breath, essentially. They both have eccentricities, and they both have a proclivity for just kind of like throwing in stuff that interests them or stuff that they find fascinating. And sometimes it's to the detriment of the overall product, where it's like, what the hell was that? It's like the Goy's teeth in a Serious Man. If you've ever seen that Coen Brothers production, I use that example a lot, the Goy's teeth, where it's like, so hang on, you just told me a big 20-minute story had no relevance to the question that I just asked for your assistance in answering. It's like, well, but I told you a story, right? It's like, Yes, that's true, but you didn't actually answer my question or give me anything that I needed. It's like, well, but at the end of the day, I told you a story, right? It's like, God damn it, you got me there, but you're not right. Yeah, I feel like Anno has a tendency to do that every once in a while, just like throw in psychobabble or science stuff, science jargon, Star Trek-esque science jargon that probably has some basis in actual science, but just doesn't feel especially welcome or relevant to what's going on, to what you would expect the main theme or the overarching narrative to be guided towards. And I got a lot of that in this, where I was like, that's interesting, but I don't know why that's here, because I don't feel like you properly followed up on it. Like, for instance, kind of a tradition in a lot of the early Kamen Rider stuff, not so much these days, but they come back to it pretty often, I guess. Like, it's kind of a part of the institution at this point, that the original Kamen Rider TV show, the evil organization, was called Shocker. And basically that was the plot, is that Kamen Rider is made by Shocker, and then he becomes a force for good fighting back against Shocker. It's a pretty simple formula, but the point is, it's this gigantic, like, unfathomably large and connected organization that it's basically a hydra. Like, you can't fully stamp it out, such that it becomes almost a running gag in subsequent Kamen Rider TV shows, where the original Shocker dies off only to be replaced by something that's the rough equivalent of it. Gel Shocker, for instance, is like the second iteration of Shocker that has like an insignia that's somewhat similar and has like a gimmick in terms of the bad guys that they churn out that's somewhat similar, but it's like, it's a different thing, though. It's like, no, it's just a rebrand is what it is. And this film, Shocker starts out as like the big bad, the thing that we're pushing back against, the thing, it's the Empire from Star Wars. It's the thing that our heroes are struggling against. And then the movie just kind of forgets about it, or decides that it's more interesting to go a different direction. And it feels clunky. Like, it feels very clumsy, where it's like, I didn't expect that. Where it's like, it's still there, but we're just not going to address it. Maybe I missed a beat or something, but there's a whole thing about AI being in charge of Shocker. There's a whole thing about artificial people and androids being involved in feeding data to Shocker and influencing Shocker's attempts to, in its own eyes, I guess, save humanity by subjugating it to some degree. But then all of that kind of gets pushed by the wayside in favor of a brother character to our leading lady, kind of serving as the final boss for the story. And I guess you could spin it that where he subsumes control of Shocker or something, like he usurps control from the AI or something, but they never say that. Like, it's never actually stated that that's what happened. It's just, we don't talk about what we talked about earlier in the movie, and now he's in the room where that thing was before. So, like, maybe it's meant to be understood that there was a transfer of power or something. Never quite figured it out. But in terms of, like, theming and stuff, like, there is some interesting stuff going on, but the storytelling is very episodic, as it was in Shin Ultraman as well, although I thought it was more efficient and more straightforward, to say the least, in that. Here we have this ongoing exploration of happiness being weaponized as a negative. So to try my best to explain it, the Shocker organization is founded by an AI, and it has a big long like the word Shocker is actually in this film a acronym that. Basically, the guiding principle for the organization is supposed to be find a way to provide the most amount of happiness to humankind, I guess at all costs. And so its physical agents act in the world. All of its physical agents are human-animal hybrids. Don't ask me to explain it. That's just how it is. It's a thing. It was a thing in the original manga and the TV show, so it's a thing here. And all of them have kind of, again, it makes me think of Hideo Kojima. Makes me think of Metal Gear whenever you encounter a boss in those games and you have to spend 20 minutes just listening to them tell you their personal philosophy on life and death. All of the chief villains in this film, who again are kind of presented to us very similar to the TV show in like chapters, where it's just like, and now here's the part where he fights the Batman, or now here's the part where he fights the Spider-Man, here's the part where he fights the Wasp Lady, and so on and so forth. All of them are given time to express via dialogue their philosophy in terms of how best to provide like happiness to the masses. So for instance, I guess not for the masses, but to provide happiness to the world, the Spider-Man, who is kind of the first chief antagonist of the film, he delights in serving the organization, in the form of punishing traitors and killing people. He's, I guess, a little bit of a sadist because he likes killing people with his bare hands and watching the life, fall out of their eyes. And then if memory serves, his whole deal is that he, and this felt a little, like if you've ever seen that a GIF from The Simpsons of all like the crowd of people pulling their collars, I think it's when the comet is coming for Springfield. They're all going, his whole deal, again, he is a Batman. His whole deal is that he delights in manufacturing viruses that kill people. Topical. His whole deal, I guess, is that he creates targeted viruses that will kill a specific chunk of the population, therefore providing easier and more fruitful lives to the survivors. Sure. Then there's the Scorpion Lady, who, as I mentioned, is played by Masami Nagasawa. She has exactly one scene in the movie, and this is a trope in Japanese media, especially Japanese media created by men. Very embarrassing scene. It's basically her getting all horny, getting all hot and bothered, murdering people. So I guess her passion is kind of similar to the Spider-Man, although just kind of more just like wanton chaos and murder. She expresses quite a lot of ecstasy and pleasure and delight in murdering many, many people. She's killed off screen in kind of a fun gag. That's the editing gag that I mentioned earlier, where we go from this lady running around cutting people's throats and spraying blood all over the place, and yelling in English, by the way, the word ecstasy, ecstasy, ecstasy. we hard cut from that to this angle looking up the nostrils of one of our government agents as he stares into a monitor and is watching all of this. And so we just get an audio only version of the chaos and the violence happening where she's at. And the only visual element is this man just kind of sternly looking to this monitor going, And the combination of the juxtaposition between the audio and the visual it's pretty funny. Because it really, like, it just sounds like he's watching a porno, is what I'm getting at. And then the Wasp Lady, I think she has powers to dominate people and make them her subjects, like they become drones to her. She's a wasp person, and in her eyes it provides harmony, like peace and harmony, in that there's no conflict between any of those people, and their mental state is happy to serve her. So in her eyes she's doing a service, and she has kind of like a pilot program going on in a small town that she hopes to expand to the rest of the world. Point is, every single villain in this movie has some sort of philosophy like this, where they're in their own eyes, from their own perspective, helping through hurting. I don't exactly know. Okay, let me try to pull this together on the fly. So there is a repetition of our hero, Takeshi Hongo. There's repetition of him wanting to protect. Like that's his default stance, is that very early in the film, his conflict comes in the form of him having been transformed against his will into a superhuman, like super powerful, like physically extraordinarily powerful, grasshopper human hybrid, who he goes by the name Kamen Rider, Masked Rider. His conflict comes from the fact that he's been imbued with these powers, and he has this will to use them, but he doesn't want to strictly use them to bring violence and death to people, because that's largely what he seems to have been designed for. So the way he justifies things is by latching on to his lady friend, Rudiko, who he, I guess in his own mind, he justifies things by determining that he is not just doing violence, he's not just fighting the bad guys, he's doing it to protect not just the world, but this woman in particular. So I feel like maybe there's a little bit of theme there going, like a counter theme to the shocker shenanigans of trying to like forcefully project happiness onto the world by doing things that from a certain point of view could be perceived as good, but end up being like a net negative. Like a counter theme to that could be Takeshi Hongo trying to provide service, like be selfless, like lay down on the sword for the greater good, as opposed to imposing his will on others or on the world. I'm rambling at this point, but I feel like maybe that's the thing, is that we're trying to valorize this idea of putting others before yourself. And in fact, there is a whole subplot about his dad kind of having been that sort of person and having been an aspirational figure to him, putting service and the comfort and safety of others above himself, which, hate to say it, speaking as a Japanese person, or at least half Japanese person, I am American, but ethnically Japanese, that is a very Japanese concept, if I am at all correct in my analysis there. As I said, Nigo, Kamen Rider 02, played by Tasuku Emoto, he really stole the show. He brought a lot of levity, and he brought a lot of the energy that I was wanting, I think, throughout more of the film, because the movie is absolutely delightful when it's in action mode. There is quite a lot of CGI in the film, which is not distracting or bad, except for when that fucking Batman is flittering about. It just doesn't look good. But for me, what was a little vexing is that I've always thought of Kamen Rider as being kind of a good showcase property for stunt and martial arts work, like tokusatsu style, like man in rubber monster suit action. I've always thought of it as being one of the more outstanding examples of that particular craft, because Ultraman, the use of the miniature sets and the optical effects in the form of like his beam weapons, like his specium beam and stuff like that, especially in the old days, like in the 60s, I feel like there were corners cut in order to make the budget manageable for that show. And as a result, Ultraman's screen time in most episodes of the show was pretty limited. I feel like that was by design, too. And Kamen Rider, though, that wasn't really the case. Like, the whole reason you watch the show is for him to henshin, for him to transform and ride his damn motorcycle and put on the helmet, and his theme music plays, and you get, you know, a good several minutes of him punching faceless goons, like guys in Lucha Libre masks, turning them into foam and such, and then at the end he jumps in the air and goes, "Right, a kick!" and goes, "Twa!" and he kicks somebody, and they explode, or they turn into bubbles, or whatever. What I'm getting at is, like, I kind of was disappointed to see basically all of the action in this rendered in CGI, because it's like, you know, if you're going to have a bigger budget and have this prestigious director at the helm, maybe it's the hardcore action and martial arts fan in me that was wanting that. But, you know, it would have been nice to have seen, like, a tribute to that style. Although, I take that back. Like, there, especially in the early goings, especially, there are sequences where we do get to see straight up just tooth and nail stunt work, like men on wires and people just throwing punches and kicks and stuff. So it's there. It's just that it most definitely takes a back seat to the CGI. And I had this thought right after I watched the movie. It stands to reason, too, that Anno's background in animation. More than likely, I would have to expect that maybe he's more comfortable working in that realm, especially when it comes to directing action. Because, you know, if we're being honest, a lot of action in blockbuster films is conducted by second unit teams rather than the actual, you know, director of the film. And as I said, the guy does have a very, very, very specific style. His brand is very, very much his own. So for creative control purposes, it does make quite a lot of sense that conducting things in a computer or an animation environment for more control would maybe make more sense to him, would provide him the control that he would maybe want or maybe need, honestly. I don't know. That's just my take. But as I said, that when this movie's in action mode, it's absolutely delightful. It's a madcap and over the top, very similar to, as I said, his previous film, Cutie Honey, from the mid 2000s. It has a very over the top and very, very playful and cartoonish quality to it that is seldom seen in a American, like, the equivalent of like a manga adaptation or something. It's very playful in how it handles things, and they really do push things to absurd limits. And it's kind of welcome, where it brushes up against the ultra serious melodrama of so many of the dialogue scenes in a charming way. I will say, I really did enjoy the bloodletting. It did make me think of the author who created Kamen Rider, the manga adaptation, Shotaro Ishinomori. I do know that a lot of his work tended to be pretty dark and pretty violent, so that was kind of fun to see them actually acknowledge that. And it does need to be said, there is a fuck ton of references to the larger Kamen Rider franchise, many of which probably went directly over my head, but one... one that I thought was really really cute, that I might be wrong in my assumption, but I'm talking directly out of my ass right now, so apologies if everything I say going forward is grossly incorrect. But I seem to remember, and I have seen maybe 14 episodes of the original Kamen Rider TV show. I did go back and like watch it when I was in college. I was curious. I wanted to see what the OG version was like, and it was a lot of fun. I actually purchased, half of my family is from Hawaii. I miss those folks. And when I was there, I purchased many, many years ago from a, I think now defunct, unfortunately, DVD publisher named Generation Kikaida, based in Honolulu, I think, if not somewhere in Hawaii. I bought a box set of Kamen Rider V3, officially licensed by this tiny Hawaiian distribution company called Generation Kikaida. I bought that box set, and I watched the fuck out of that. If you probably aren't aware, but Kamen Rider V3 was the second Kamen Rider television show. And I've often heard it's like one of the better ones, too. I absolutely loved it. And in fact, being as it was only the second show in the whole overarching franchise, the mega franchise, Kamen Rider 1 and 2, the characters from the original TV show, make appearances in that show. It was great. I loved it. So I'm just laying all my bona fides on the table right now is what I'm doing. Sorry about that. Point is, I have seen a little bit of the original Kamen Rider show. The Easter egg that I think I noticed here. There is a portion of the film where Kamen Rider 1 and 2 come to blows. Number 2 isn't quite all right in the head at the time, and he's eager to fight. So the two of them go at it. Kamen Rider 1 suffers a gnarly leg break. Your leg is not meant to face that direction, my friend. It is nasty looking. I'm sorry, but for a bright and colorful film, in many instances, that was like, oh Jesus, when his leg snaps the wrong way. And he goes down, and he's obviously not able to get to his feet. And then some other stuff happens. What I'm getting at here is that I seem to remember the story being, the original Kamen Rider, the original TV show, that is, the actor who played the original Kamen Rider, I seem to remember him suffering an actual injury, maybe even in a motorcycle accident, like independent of the TV show, independent of the production of the TV show. Hiroshi Fujioka, by the way, is the name of the actor, in case you're curious. And if memory serves, that injury occurred pretty early in the production of the original Kamen Rider show. And as a result, the way that Toei decided to handle it was, instead of recasting him, instead of doing the Darren, like they did in, Bewitched, and just having a different actor step in for the previous guy, they decided to change the narrative or speed things up in some way. I don't remember if Kamen Rider 02 is from the manga or not, probably. But they basically inserted the Kamen Rider 2 character and had Hayato Ichimonji, the character, step in for Hongo Takeshi. And then for most of the run of the original Kamen Rider, Kamen Rider 2 served as the main character of the TV show because the original guy was injured and unable to perform. I want to say that maybe that leg break was a nod to that real life incident on the production of the original TV show or something. Could be wrong, but I do seem to remember that being a story from the production of that TV show. But yeah, on the whole, I did find the movie to be not especially cohesive. It does have melodramatic moments, in particular involving the relationship between our leading man and leading lady. I did like their interplay. It is kind of fun, although there is, I don't know, there is a certain chunk of the film that's devoted to her that I think was meant to make me feel more or tear up in some way, and it just didn't happen. Good performance. I did like the way that their relationship had been scripted up until that point, but I don't know, it kind of felt a little bit flat for me. And then by the time you get to the finale, I was like a little confused, where we have a chief antagonist for the film established, but he doesn't show up until more than halfway through the movie. He's not seen until sometime after that as well. And he's kind of standing in for something that I was much more interested in at the time. So he kind of just arrives, and it didn't feel especially earned. It felt a little half-baked, I guess. Which was unfortunate. The final battle's kind of nice, I guess. We do get a whatever it takes moment between our two leading heroes. That was, I'm a sucker for that. When you know your two guys are beat to shit and they got to look each other in the eye and say, well, it's Lethal Weapon 4. When Danny Glover and Mel Gibson are about to go after Jet Li, and Mel Gibson is just talking about like, you know, he took my gun apart with like just one smooth motion. Just how did he do that, Raj? How did he do that? And Danny Glover just looks at him and he's like, you're talking in circles right now. Like you're alluding to what I know you want to do right now, but you're not actually saying it. You're letting me decide what the play is here. And that's very gracious of you, Mel Gibson. And Danny Glover just looks at him and he's like, yeah, let's go ask him. It's like, okay, let's go beat this guy's ass. It's like, he's probably going to wreck our shit. We're probably going to die. But you know, it's got to happen. I am such a sucker for that moment in any media. That just that deep breath before the guys you love throw themselves to their doom. Or it's Butch Cassidy and Sundance. Although that's less satisfying because you know, I'll just in case you haven't seen that movie, I won't say anymore. Anyway, but we do get that moment. It's kind of cool. The fight choreography is okay, although again, covered in a little bit too much CGI flash. I was like, can you scale it back? Just let the guy do his moves. And I looked up the actor, Mirai Moriyama, the guy who plays our villain, the butterfly Og. He apparently has a very dense background in dance. The guy can move. Let him move. I want to see. Show me. Where is Babu? Show me Babu. If you got a guy who can dance, let me see him dance. Don't cover it in CGI light blooms and ruin the whole thing. It's not that they ruined it. It's just like, you know, sometimes I just want to see the guys do the moves. And they kind of did that a little bit with some of the wrestling that happens. That I guess they're going for like a pathetic and desperate, like kind of like animalistic struggle there towards the very end of that particular conflict. I kind of got what they were going for there, but it wasn't especially satisfying, if I'm being honest. But yeah, if I'm being honest, I think I have to. I'm obligated to rate this, unfortunately, the lowest of Anno's Shin films, which pains me somewhat because I really like Kamen Rider. I love Kamen Rider. And this movie does have some occasional shining moments of brilliance, largely coming in the form of the original TV show score playing, or at least a remixed version of it, and you know, the Kamen Rider flying up into the sky and drop kicking a motherfucker straight into the ground. Those moments are you know, crowd pleasing, like rip roaring cheering kind of moments, and every time they happen, they're great. Although I'll roll that back just 1 second, point out that the Shocker Riders, the evil Kamen Riders that show up in like the penultimate conflict in the film, that whole sequence is very, I don't think shooting all of that in darkness was the right move, especially when Kamen Rider 2 has the same colored eyes as all of the evil Riders. At least the Rider 1 has like pink eyes and the other ones have red eyes. His are also red. So in terms of clarity, I felt like I was robbed of some enjoyment there. It was a little bit unfortunate. I did like the images of the evil riders like riding in formation. They do have some cute dialogue there where they're talking about how grasshoppers can also become locusts and they become they're gregarious. So it's kind of interesting to see like how he's portrayed as a solitary, reluctant hero. And then the evil equivalent, they're social and they harmonize and they move in concert with one another. That was interesting on a thematic level, but visually it felt, I hate to say it, but it felt kind of chintzy. Like it felt kind of cheap because it felt like they clone stamped, like they used the exact same CGI model for all those characters. Like, well, that made somebody's life a lot easier. I don't know if it made the movie better, but it definitely made the movie easier to make. So I guess that's something. But yeah, I wasn't super thrilled with that, although we did get some henshin, some transformation posing The girlfriend grabbed my knee and shook it when that happened because I told her, expect much posing, expect much, not hand jive, but vigorous gesticulations. And the movie did deliver on that. So that made me and her happy. I am a fanboy at heart. And also they play the theme music. They play the theme song at the end. And I will admit, I did sing a few bars of it on my way out of the theater. Not something I do in public very often. But I do, in fact, know that theme song like the back of my hand. And it is absolutely wonderful. And it did make me smile. It made me smile like a child, like a little boy leaving the theater to that, let's go. It was pretty great. But yeah, I my friend who I went with has zero connection to Kamen Rider, and he quite liked it. He really enjoyed it, in fact. He was like, I had a lot of fun with that. Thanks for inviting me. And I was like, yeah, no problem, bud. And the girlfriend, she agrees with me. She wasn't super into it. She she likes her characters, and she likes things to make sense. And unfortunately, this movie didn't have too much to offer on those fronts. She said that she was like only a few minutes deep before she just kind of threw her hands up and decided, I can't follow this, therefore I will not try. But she agreed with me that, you know, when it's rolling, when it's on, and, you know, the theme music is blasting and heads are exploding and blood is spraying, it's lovely. But on the whole, it just lacks cohesion. And I'm not entirely certain what I was supposed to get out of it. Whereas the other Shin movies, they seem to be tighter, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Not terrible at all. I did enjoy it. Just the lesser of three very, very good films. One of which I'd call brilliant, one of which I would call excellent, and this one I would call good. So unfortunate, but that's how it is. Actually, probably going to be talking about Creed 3 tomorrow, in fact, with my older brother. And if I'm being honest, I kind of have the same relationship with those movies. Creed 1, brilliant. Creed 2, excellent. Creed 3, good. So spoiler alert for next week, I guess. But I have said way more than I ever intended to about this film. And my throat hurts. So I'm going to call it quits here at this point. This was not really a review, but this was more of just a talk. This was Trevor talking about a movie that he has no one, absolutely no one to talk to about. So it's perfect candidate, absolutely perfect candidate for a solo episode. So this was Shin Kamen Rider, directed by Hideaki Anno from the year 2023. And if you would like to catch up on any of our other Catching Up on Cinema content, you can find all of that collected on our website at catchinguponcinema.com. You can also find us on the social medias in the form of the Twitter at Catching Cinema and the Instagram at Catching Up on Cinema. So feel free to hit me up at either of those. And the podcast is available on pretty much every platform you can imagine, including Bitcade. And if you could please like, share, and subscribe, that'd be just dandy. That'd be doing me a favor. So thanks for that. But that being said, thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.